Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to This Week in Accountable Care. I'm your host, Greg Masters, and we have resumed our weekly scheduled broadcasting, and I'm delighted to say that on the show today, I get to chat with who is making an encore appearance on This Week in Accountable Care, J.D. Kleinke. J.D. Kleinke is a pioneering healthcare information entrepreneur, medical economist, author, policy expert, and business strategist. He's been instrumental in the creation of healthcare information for healthcare information organizations, helps hospital systems, insurers, and physician groups prepare for medical computerization and health reform, provides business, product, and technology strategy services to new and established healthcare companies, and sat on the boards of several public and privately held health information companies. J.D. Kleinke has authored three books on the U.S. healthcare system: Bleeding Edge, The Business of Healthcare in the New Century, and Oxymorons, The Myth of a U.S. Healthcare System, and more recently, Catching Babies, published in 2012. J.D.'s work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Barron's, Health Affairs, JAMA, the British Medical Journal, Modern Healthcare, Managed Healthcare, Forbes, and numerous other publications. Since his earliest writings on health policy and market dynamics in the Wall Street Journal in the early 90s, J.D. has been long known as a forceful, nonpartisan advocate for an evidence-driven, computerized, patient-centric healthcare system. So with that as the formal introduction, and might I say he's just an all-around good guy. J.D., welcome to the broadcast.
Well, thanks, Greg.
And that was good to have you back. And, of course, there is no shortage of topics in health reform and accountable care or accountable care organizations in particular. But let's back up since I saw you last in D.C. a while back. There's been a status change in your life, but give us an update on where you're at these days.
Well, status change, I think that was a year ago. I was in the middle of my one-year fellowship with the American Enterprise Institute, and God, that may even have been before the election. So a lot had shifted then. I think the belief for a big portion of the world back before the election in November, and when I was sitting in that chair, was that the Obamacare stuff was going to go away. It was the big bad dream. The Supreme Court may have lost its mind, but of course the American people won't lose its mind, and they're going to throw the bastard out. And of course none of that happened. We did reelect the president, and the Supreme Court did or didn't lose its mind. But we are now in a year of implementation, for better or for worse. We are trying to make this incredibly complicated thing work, and that's where everybody is. It's heads down. The other story from Washington that's interesting and has lots of people talking and a lot of people not really getting any clarity because there is no real clarity from anybody about all this is what's really going to happen. The White House has been strangely silent. Even the folks from HHS have been strangely silent. But out there in the meanwhile, we got, 30,000-40,000 people working in earnest, building exchanges, getting their health insurance plan ready to deal with this. Employers trying to figure out what the hell is going to happen. We're in a state of it's suspended animation. We really don't know where we're going to end up. But we do know October 1st is coming. The exchanges are going to go live. Suddenly people are going to be able to enroll in these newfangled things. And then more importantly, on January 1st, a whole lot of new rules are going to kick in. Those exchanges will be working or they won't be working. But more broadly, everyone's very focused on the exchanges, but the exchanges are sort of at the margins. The big picture story is on Jan 1. Jan 1, if you're sick, suddenly you're protected. You can't get kicked out of a plan. If you want to enroll in health insurance, no one can say no because you were sick. So a whole lot of stuff is coming, and a whole lot of people are working really, really hard on it. And there isn't a whole lot of political guidance going on. People are wondering, you know, what's happening with the president? The president has made this very courageously years ago. He spent a tremendous amount of political capital. Some would argue the biggest bet he made his entire political career was to push through this plan. And now the plan is going slowly into and laboriously into effect. And there's been a lot of silence. What's really happening? What are they really after? How's this thing going to be implemented? Into that void, into that vacuum comes the naysayers, comes a lot of negative press, a lot of people defining it critically, a lot of people saying it won't work. Premiums are going to get out of control. Employers are going to drop coverage. The world's going to blow up. So we have a lot of negative definition of what's supposed to be happening. Not a lot of positive yet. So who knows? The word from Washington is, we'll see. Make it work. That's what Bill Clinton said. So we'll see.
So there's this complex law out there, the Affordable Care Act, with many moving parts and predated by the era and the high-tech provisions. All this stuff actually is interdependent in mission-critical ways, and if you yank one of the pillars out, it seems that the whole thing could potentially collapse or the value add be materially compromised. Would that be a fair characterization? And maybe you could take a minute and even outline those four pillars.
Well, they are.
Whatever the number is.
Yeah, whatever the number is. This stuff is, a lot of it's interdependent. You know, the health insurance companies were counting on a very certain interdependency. You know, bring us your sick, bring us your tired, bring us your poor, bring us your uninsurable with pre-existing conditions, and we'll insure them, but you're going to have to bring us revenue, and you're going to have to bring us healthy people, and you're going to have to bring us people who are paying up because they're afraid of a penalty and they're under the mandate and all that stuff. So this was, like any attempt at health reform ought to be, especially big ones. There are a lot of moving parts that are interdependent. The health insurance industry is counting on if they're going to start to cover sick people and charge them all the same thing within much tighter parameters than ever before. And then they're going to count on a whole lot of healthy people showing up and a lot of the poorer ones with subsidized coverage. So all that stuff's very interdependent. When you mention high tech, I think you're talking about something that's very much related to ACOs, and that is the other big news in Washington, which is the computerization stuff. This is a battle we fought a really long time ago, and I don't know if people are paying attention, but it's hard to pay attention. There are a lot of fights in Washington about a lot of things. But the fight and it's not as big as immigration or guns or all the other things that weren't solving those problems. But the one that seems to have come back up in healthcare as it relates to ACOs and as it relates to healthcare IT, and I have to say, shockingly, we're rethinking whether or not we want to computerize healthcare, whether or not the government has a role in trying to deal with the fact that the market itself won't computerize, that doctors and hospitals and all those people have had traditionally for decades have had a disincentive not to computerize, not to get online, not to look at whether or not a patient that they're now seeing has ever been tested as part of the system, what's wrong with them, what's their man list, all that stuff. You know, a battle, an argument, I thought we all had agreed on decades ago. Well, not decades ago, you know, a decade and a half ago. And slowly, through the Bush administration and then through the Obama administration, we decided computerizing medicine is a good thing. It's a good thing that doctors actually act like factory workers from the 80s, and they use a computer, and they actually look at what they're doing. They share information and all that stuff, and it's a long, slow, miserable, torturous road to get there. But, you know, the problem didn't get solved overnight. The solution isn't perfect, and there's a lot of malcontents out there. Those malcontents have, you know, and they're always out there. We see them. They publish, and they're on the blogs, and they're out there. But all of a sudden, they seem to have gotten enough attention on Capitol Hill, and that attention has aligned really nicely, unfortunately, with people who just, you know, if Obama said it, it must be wrong. If Obama did it, it must be horrible. And there are people on Capitol Hill that, well, this is an Obama program. We have to figure out how to attack it. And so, for better or for worse, a program which is to create a system to subsidize and fix and deal with and slowly get us onto the road to computerization of healthcare. Something started under the prior administration, George W. Bush, under David Brailer. That idea, and it is a 20-year process, and that's when I go back that far politically, that thing suddenly is now a monstrosity of the Obama administration. That's under attack. And the reason I'm belaboring this and digressing is because critical to it, an ACO, critical to the future of healthcare, if we actually are going to figure out how to take care of people, reduce costs, make it, you know, improve quality, minimize bad outcomes, all of that stuff, take errors out of the system, all the stuff we need to do, the whole point of really the ACO, which is to remake, truly reform the way we do patient care in this country, that's going to require computerization, right? Tracking somebody when they come in to the hospital, tracking them when they leave, making sure they're compliant on their medications, making sure they're not getting two medications from two doctors that are going to conflict and kill them. Really basic ideas. That requires computerization. That's not a straight line. We all know when we first got our first computer, or we switched from PC to Mac or whatever it was, that's a difficult process. We're trying to do that on a grand scale for a sixth of the economy, the computerization of medicine. That is a really long, slow, hard, difficult process. Doesn't occur in straight lines, and God, it has generated, as we all know, a tremendous amount of and complexity and dislocation and angst in people. And the people that have that angst, and they're very good at expressing it, have gotten an audience on Capitol Hill. So suddenly, I can't believe we're fighting a rear guard action in this. I thought we had this argument a long time ago. But the big news in Washington right now is that we're actually having a significant resistance to, should we continue to fund the conversion of physician and hospital practices to computerized systems? Yeah, you know, and the New York Times big piece 6 months ago and about all that, and you know, so we're now dealing with a serious rear guard action, Greg, and it's just kind of, I guess it would have been predicted, but it's a little disappointing.
I don't think this is a digression in any way, shape, or form, because infrastructure as the central spine of any vision around accountable care or the triple aim is non-negotiable. And if you look at the business models, the sustainable business models that actually work out there, infrastructure, health IT infrastructure is the central spine. So no diversion as far as I can tell. But other than this internecine government that we seem to have, which is circle the wagons and shoot in kind of philosophy, what compelling argument could there conceivably be against defunding high tech and the incentives to adopt EHRs, other than, okay, it's early in the game, there's some limited examples where you know, maybe this doesn't always add value. In fact, it can add cost and maybe be some interoperability issues and possibly quality issues. But what conceivable argument could they be making? And is this a serious look-see or just maybe a whim of a senator or two?
Well, that is the question. And if you look at there's published research and there's a tremendous amount of opinion on the internet, and all of it that's legitimate relates to this is disruptive. This screws up the clinical workflow. This complicates things. It used to work this way. It didn't work so well, but it worked. And now we're tearing it up and we're starting over. And anytime you automate, I remember the first time I switched from handwriting to using a computer, first time we all switched from using DOS to using Windows, and then from using a PC to using a Mac, we lose time, and we lose effort, and it's confusing, and there's downtime. And those are trivial compared to being a doctor and working with a stethoscope and writing something down and barking orders at a nurse versus I'm actually going to chart somebody electronically. That's a much bigger deal than going from PC to Mac or going from handwriting to, but it's the medical equivalent. So it is disruptive, and we are in the middle of it, and it's not going to just take a week. It's going to take years. And in the middle of that, you have this huge backlash of people who are legitimately concerned about disruption, patients who fall through the cracks in the middle of all of that. You know, there will be problems. The systems won't be perfect. There'll be downtime. All those things will happen. But you know what? Those things happened in the old world also. Patients were lost. Notes were missed. People didn't call back. People got lost in phone tag. And those people also died. And those medical errors also occurred. But you know what? You just chalk that up to the way the world was. Now we can chalk it up to the disruption to the clinical workflow. So that's all real. That's all legitimate. And it is a horrendous disruption. That's kind of legitimate. Then now we get into the kind of less legitimate, darker stuff. There are people out there, and they're equally as vocal, and they're very articulate, who are just pissed. They're mad at managed care. They're mad that their dreams didn't come true. They're mad they didn't get rich. They didn't become God. Whatever reason that they thought they were going to, or they were going to take over, and then these are the same people who crusaded against managed care, and then they crusaded against data, they crusaded against ratings, they crusaded against accountability, they crusaded against transparency. There is a very vocal class of people, mostly led by physicians of a certain generation, who are mad, and it doesn't matter why they're mad, and it doesn't matter what the source of that madness is. They're just pissed. So the latest thing to be pissed about, because it's not managed care anymore, and it's not the drug companies because they're not doing so well anymore, and it's EMRs. This is the latest reason I don't make $1 million a year and I'm not God anymore. But I'll make it about EMRs, okay? You know what I'm talking about, Greg?
Yes, I do. I think it's a target-rich environment, yes.
It is a target-rich environment for malcontents. And the psychological phenomenon is known as projection. This is the thing that, you know, I'm really frustrated because, you know, I sacrificed 10 years of my life and I went to pre-med and I didn't have any fun, and then I went to med school and I suffered, and then I went to residency and I suffered, and now you expect me to use a computer like an ordinary secretary? And they're pissed. And so they take it all out on the EMR world and all these crooked people at all these vendors and all these corrupt government officials, and it's just gigantic act of psychological projection for all of their professional frustrations. And that's the second reason, and that's dark. Now, it's really the third thing that's particularly dark about this, and this is the problem that we have politically with Obamacare, is there are people out there who don't care about this. They don't care about healthcare. They don't care about computerization. They just want to get the president, right? They just don't like the status quo. They have political agendas. They are ideologues. They don't like the government. They don't like President Obama for one reason or another. And so this must be bad. This must be Obama's fault. It's raining. Blame the president. That's also bizarre. That also is, you know, very effective on Capitol Hill. Because half the people on Capitol Hill, if it's raining, it's the president. You know, right? This question is the president, whatever. And so there's a weird ideological that has nothing to do with healthcare, nothing to do with computers. Nonetheless, there is a very strong current in Washington, which is if something in life, if you have a canker sore, it's the president's fault. And so that's what's going with a lot of the EMR. It's the Obama administration. I'm like, you guys, this is a program adopted under the Bush administration. This idea started with David Brailer. It was a good idea a long time ago, and it was supported by a guy named Tom Frist, Republican Senate Majority Leader. It was implemented by a guy named David Brailer, a Republican, under a Republican president, right? This isn't our idea, you know, but nonetheless, we've now inherited it. So it's, suddenly it's now an ideological problem.
And the, at least the ideological antecedents run to the fact that the HMO Act was also offered by a Republican president, as in Richard Nixon. So, you know, that's part – I'm listening to you, and I'm sinking into a little bit of darkness. I'm wondering, you know, the East Coast needs to come to the West Coast and get a little more sunshine, you know, in their chemistry, because there might be a little less propensity to want to point the fingers and project on others. But then again, that just could be my 60s idealism coming back. But is there a possibility for a Rodney King moment where we can all get along here, or is this, are we just destined to spiral into a black hole where the government literally just says, steps in and says, okay, party's over, you know, top down, single payer?
Well, that I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the Rodney King moment, and I had hoped that the EMR would be the Rodney King moment, where when, in, you know, 10 years ago, when you saw Hillary Clinton standing on stage with Newt Gingrich, and they said computerizing healthcare would solve a lot of these problems. It's nonpartisan. Who's against a computerized healthcare system? How is that a Democrat versus a Republican thing? That could have been the Rodney King moment. The Rodney King moment is going to, you know, the next one, if we could have one, will be when the implementation of Obamacare works out okay. It's not going to solve all the problems in life, and there'll still be people without insurance. There'll still be cost problems and all that. But a lot of the stuff at the margins, the wild, crazy stuff, the people getting dumped by the ER because they're dying, or the people that can't get any insurance at all because they have cancer, the crazy, outrageous stuff at the margins is going to get reined in by this plan. You know, the most egregious, ugly stuff that healthcare in America can produce is going to get reined in. So that could be our Rodney King moment as well. I don't want to dwell too much on the EMR stuff, and I think the EMR stuff will eventually get fixed. I really just hope, and I think anyone listening that's interested in this can have some impact on this, is we need to give computers the benefit of the doubt. Look what they've done for every other part of our lives. Look at how they've affected every other industry. And we just need to give them a couple years. You know, we're just 2-3 years into a conversion that, you know, the auto industry took 20 years to integrate computers. The office work, we're still dealing with that. It takes decades to change the culture of work in any industry. And that's before you add the culture of medicine, which is the most nuanced, subtle, information-intensive, intuitive, you know, gigantically complex work. There's nothing more complex than diagnosing a patient, right, and taking care of them and treating them over time and tracking them over time and space. And we need to just give this stuff a couple years to work out before we instantly turn on it and say, this wasn't, you know, this is a false god. This wasn't the panacea. This didn't fix everything that was wrong with healthcare. Well, no one ever said it would. But we do know that a computerized healthcare system is better than a paper-based, memory-based, phone tag-based system. It has to be. And then that becomes the foundation for our form system that does track people based on outcomes and quality and all these other things that require knowledge.
So let's pivot to basically at least the role of the accountable care organization or a derivative form, call it what you may, accountable care enterprise. Where are you on the bullish bearish scale for this being a proactive part of the macro solution? Talk about what you're seeing both at the macro level and whatever you can share from maybe some micro experience of individual.
My friends out there in the real world, they are the ACSF. I'm as bearish as ever, and it's not because of Obamacare, and it's not because of any of the other things that a politician may pronounce. And there'll be big news out of Washington about the latest attempt to do all this stuff. The ACO stuff that works is day-to-day blocking and tackling contracting between a group of providers and a payer. And I think that stuff, even if Obamacare had never been created or passed, or if it had been repealed, or he had not been reelected, and so Obamacare went away. The ACO idea transcends all of that. The ACO, the genius of the Obamacare plan, and the reason it's so complicated is because it's not disrupting much. It's just cramming 30 million people into the existing system, as complicated as Medicaid over here, employers over there, and all that other stuff, right? As that relates to the ACO, all the Obama plan does is try to accelerate a reality that was already in place, a trajectory we are already on. Humana, Cigna, WellPoint, all the big plans in this country who understand this problem and have been struggling with it for decades have been trying to put in place global payments, withholds, bonuses for good outcomes. These are not new ideas. These are not new ideas at all. These are decades-long ideas, which is fee-for-service is a corrupt, stupid system. We need to pay doctors and hospitals to get along, to work together, to share data, to figure out the best way to take care of people, to make sure that people, when they're sick, are compliant with their medication orders and try to do as good a job as we can at getting them better and keeping them better and keeping them out of the system, right? That idea is not an Obamacare idea. That idea has been around for a very long time. That idea goes back to the HMO Act of the 70s, and it's what Kaiser has been trying to build forever. And so that stuff, about the fundamental impulse behind the ACO is Obamacare independent. Obamacare, because it is a violent endorsement of the status quo, simply tried to seize on what was hot and new and the latest way of packaging the same old idea. And this is the same old idea I've just been describing. That's going to outlast this sort of daily political wiggle of Obamacare good, Obamacare bad. Will it work? Won't it work? Humana, Cigna, Aetna, WellPoint, these guys are changing the way they're paying for care, finally, slowly. That does nothing to do with health reform. As a matter of fact, you even think about the irony of ACL. Based payment in Obamacare, it's not affecting the exchange plans. It's about Medicare. It's a separate population, but they managed to cram it into the Obamacare bill because that's when they could do that. But the actual payments that are in play under Obamacare for an ACO are Medicare withholds or Medicare bonuses based on Medicare, not on the exchange folks. The ACO is an idea that predates this president and that will outlast this president.
Well, I didn't mean to stop you there. We're just going to wind down the live portion of the broadcast. JD, if you do have some time, I want to follow through with your history lesson, which is, I think, essential context for people to put their arms around and grasp what's going on here, because we do need some advocacy out there to communicate and convey a complex piece of legislation as to its
benefits. So as it works its way through, actually. So, folks, can you hang out for a little bit, JD?
Sure.
Okay. So we're going to wind down the live portion of the broadcast. I've been speaking with J.D. Kleinke, economist and innovative thinker in the health reform sphere. We're going to continue in overtime. Thanks for joining us. Okay, thanks, J.D. A little bit of flow disruption between live and archived show, but... You know, it's so important to understand what you're talking about, particularly that an accountable care organization or the ACO provisions inside the Affordable Care Act is really nothing new. It's simply almost a rebranding at another level of what's already happening in the marketplace. You know, some have said kind of what I'm getting at with you is many have looked at ACOs as, well, they won't work, too little, too late, HMO light, no teeth. You know, how could that work when even HMOs are failing, broad brush, when even HMOs are failing, subject to interpretation. But it's simply an expression of blocking and tackling, vision, integration, alignment of incentives, you know, and getting providers and payers to on the same hymnal. You know, that's really what it's about. Unfortunately, I mean, what I'm seeing is in the ACO sphere from the Medicare Shared Savings Program point of view, whether it's the Pioneers or the Advanced Payment Model or the Standard Program, everyone thinks of an ACO in terms of Medicare Shared Savings. But there's also derivatives out there in the commercial space, which are much less regulated, if you will, and really come down to smart terms and conditions and contracts that are out there reporting incredible, incredible results. Bed day reductions, admit reductions, 40-50%, you know. So, you know, there are those who are in that internecine warfare, you know, and then there are those out there doing. So what are you seeing on the doing front?
Well, the doing front is, like I said earlier, it's and you just said it's in the real world, and it's one contract at a time. Because you can't solve the whole world. If you're an ACO and you are trying to survive, you got a payer mix and you've got a bottom line, right? And you can't do anything stupid. You can't kill yourself to do the right thing, because you're going to reduce your revenue from, you know, WellPoint, because you started doing the right thing. You're going to have to, in your WellPoint, I'm being very specific about an imaginary California-based healthcare system, you're going to have to say to WellPoint, unless you guys are willing to pay us on a case rate basis for this kind of patient over here, and I'm talking very specific contract language, right, for people that had congestive heart failure or hip replacement, unless you pay us this much money over here, we're going to change nothing and we're going to run the table, right? we're going to pay the docs, and we're going to not care if the patients get well, and we're going to stick them out there in the cab and they're going to drive away and hopefully they'll be okay. But if they're not okay, it's not so bad for us. They come back. You know, you've got a very, very specific, it's a payer-by-payer game. You know, for all the huge talk, Greg, and you and I, you know, can get into this like anybody, right? For all the big, huge talk about the system ought to change and people ought to skin in the game and Congress ought to, like, you know, go to the moon and, you know, it comes down to a type of patient and it comes down to a payer contract. What is WellPoint going to pay you for or not? And that's what you do. And
right.
If it's a big enough payer, and I say California and WellPoint, not randomly. It has to be a big payer. It has to be a really big payer with enough volume that you're going to screw around and have meetings and tell your doctors to get your head off the phone, pay attention, because here's what's happening with WellPoint, because they represent a third of our patients in here, right? And it comes down to very, very tactical, this payer, this contract, this population. And if it's a big enough payer and a big enough population, that will then foment culture change
right.
laterally to the small payers, to the medium payers.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not going to change anything if you're a pension plan in Orange County or you're a peripheral payer in California. You have to be a big payer.
Right.
And that's the thing, because, you know, it requires, we're not just talking about changing, we're talking about reversing
right.
decades of weird incentives based in screwed up cultural stuff.
And I'm glad you mentioned WellPoint because the antecedent organization, Blue Cross of California, in its really, shall I say, most in the beginning of its innovation cycle, which dates back to the 80s, I would say, Leonard Schaefer, you know, former administrator of HCFA, comes and retools Blue Cross of California, and out comes the prudent buyer plan. And this thing called the PPO is invented on top of a very limited HMO line. But they continue to morph. WellPoint takes formation. And then WellPoint, seeing the future, acquires CareMore, which has kind of that whole disease management, retooling the enterprise, managing the patient at the level of point of care from a population perspective, and watch CareMore retool WellPoint, you know, the wag the dog thing here. So there's a, I don't know if you saw it, but I came across a report today by Oliver Wyman, and they have a case study, which they are featuring, among others, what CareMore is doing in their model. So if you haven't seen it, I'll send it to you.
Okay. No, and Leonard Schaefer is a very smart man, and he said one of the most interesting things to me in my entire career. One of the things that I'll never forget. We were sitting here talking, and we were with the CEO of a big drug company, and Leonard and somebody else, very smart guy. And I kept referring to, pointing to Leonard as the payer. Well, the payer will do this. Well, the payer. And Leonard finally interrupts me, and he says, J.D., stop calling me the payer. I don't like the payer.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't like the payer. So if somebody, an ACO or somebody else, can figure out a way,
right.
at the end of the day, it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
It comes down to they don't want to pay, and you, the provider, want to make more money, right?
Yeah.
So the money has to come from somewhere.
Right.
And if that somewhere can come from disease or stupidity or suffering, then you both win, right? And Leonard gets that, and I think the smart people that run the ACOs get that as well. We just need to figure out a way that the person who ought to be paying isn't WellPoint, and it isn't the hospital, / doctor corporation. It ought to be suffering. It ought to be the person. It ought to be like the rest of us, the public health, whoever. But Leonard was very smart about that. He got that right away. And we just need to get that authenticated contract at a time.
That's great. That's great. Tied to that whole argument is, do you think Medicare Advantage contractors have an inherent advantage in the ACO space? And can ACOs compete with Medicare Advantage contractors in their market?
Well, that's a great question. That's kind of the same question, right? Yes, Medicare Advantage is the model. A Medicare Advantage is an at-risk program for dealing with a publicly paid benefit. And to the degree that the Medicare Advantage programs have tried to move towards some kind of global payment, some kind of fixed payment for a case, whatever it is, then they are ready for the brave new worlds generally. The exchange plan or anybody else that's going to come along and say, you know, I don't want to pay for service for this stuff. You guys get paid to screw up, and I don't think that's a good thing. So a Medicare Advantage plan that actually is taking charge of a population or doing some capitated-based payment or whatever it is perfectly situated.
Well, there you have it. That's going to That's going to have to be the last word from J.D. Kleinke, a man whose thoughts, opinions, and actions have always inspired me. You can follow J.D. online at jdkonline.com. He is a prolific writer, author, blogger. Many of his posts also appear on the healthcare blog, and there's just a litany here. You know, the conservative case for Obamacare in the New York Times, Fool's Gold Rush, Obamacare and the Medicaid opportunity on Forbes. You know, he's got a list of really seminal posts in the health reform area. So I encourage you to follow JD, and he's also on Twitter, JDK on Health. Follow him on Twitter as well. JD, thanks for your time. I always enjoy our chat together, and I look forward to our paths crossing. Will you be going to, by any chance, are you going to D.C. for Health Innovation Week, Health Data Palooza, all that stuff?
I will be there.
Excellent.
We'll
look for you then. Okay. Well, Jay, we've been speaking with J.D. Kleinke. This is Greg Masters for This Week in Accountable Care. Please join us next week for another episode. And thanks for joining, everybody. Bye now. Thanks, J.D. Okay. That was when I